In Romans chapter 7, Paul is dealing fundamentally with the issues of how we're to relate to law. And in that light, there are a couple of things that I want to mention before we actually take on the chapter itself. I had a long-running disputation with some folks that called themselves the Church of Christ years ago. And I discovered in my interaction that one of the ways they got out of having to deal with all of this stuff that the Bible says about law was they would say all of Paul's talk about the law was about the Mosaic law. And though we're not under the law, he was just saying we were not under the Mosaic law. He didn't mean we weren't under the New Testament law. And on they would go. And one of their arguments was that if God gave a command, it implied implicitly that you could do what he's telling you to do, and therefore you should. And, of course, I've been teaching exactly the opposite all this time. And one of the reasons I bring this up is because as I was reading through the Gospels this week, I noticed that Jesus, in his dealings with the disciples, when the multitude had been there and he was going to feed the 5,000, and again, the feeding of the 4,000, but fundamentally in the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples come to him and tell him that it's getting late and he needs to send the people away so they can go into the villages and wherever they might be able to find a cafe open or snack shop or whatever so they could buy them something to eat. And Jesus just point blankly said, you feed them. And the imperative mood does not imply capacity. You feed them is a command, but it's very clear from the way the story unfolds, that he never intended for them to feed him except as a secondary outworking of his provision for the food. Yes, they fed them in the sense that they handed it out. But the very idea, you feed them, their reaction immediately was, well, shall we spend 200 denarii to buy enough for everyone to have a little bit? Because there were 5,000 men and no telling how many women and children. And the thing you have to keep in mind is that 200 denarii, a denarius was one day's wage. 200 of them would have been something over 6 months' wages. And if you were just to transpose that into the setting where we have, you take 6 months of income to spend on a meal for 5,000 plus people. And you can see where they were going with that. They may not have even had 200 denarii in Judas's pocket because he was the treasurer. But nonetheless, I think the feeding of the 5,000 is a clear-cut example of how Jesus expects us to respond when he gives us a command. He expects us to depend on him for the capacity for that command to be fulfilled. And without his direct input and capacity, we don't have the ability to fulfill it. So that leads us into our study for this evening in Romans chapter 7, because in our study last time, we doubled down on the issue of the nature of the law in verse 7, where because twice Paul said in the context that the law was used by sin, the sin literally, to sponsor all kinds of sins in the individuals who were subject to law. And that automatically for him meant that we had to draw some conclusions about the nature of the law itself. So verse 7 started out, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? So he doubled down on this issue, the question of the law's character. Is it, as a tool of the sin, necessarily therefore itself sinful? And the answer was emphatically negative. But he also coupled that to a declaration that opens the door of our understanding of the divine purpose for law. Because in the last half of the verse, he said, on the contrary, I would not have come to know the sin except through the law. I would not have known about, they translated coveting, but the word is lusting. If the law had said, you shall not lust. So by that declaration, he is actually saying that the real significance of law is to make something known. In other words, it's revelation. And whether there's any regulation in that or not depends entirely on where you're looking for the ability for the regulation. I mean, if a person's walking by the Spirit of God, he doesn't even need the regulation of the law, because the Spirit will produce fruit that is not contrary to law. So Paul's point was that a proper understanding of God's purpose for law involves seeing it as only a tool for revealing to men the true nature of sin and their sins. So that if they were sinning and didn't know it, the law would come along and reveal it to them so that they could then know that their behavior was not acceptable. It's sinful. And in our study this evening, we're going to look into verse 8, where he talks about the sin using the law and the subsequent need then for believers to accept their status as having been removed from the domain of law altogether, because the end of the verse says, apart from law, sin's dead, and we need to buy into that reality. But how is the real issue, and that's where we're going in this chapter. The whole chapter is given over to how a believer is supposed to relate to the issue of law, and it gets a little detailed and complicated, but we're going to work our way through. So we're going to look at verse 8, and then just by way of for your information's sake, verse 11, it says sin taking opportunity. Verse 11 says sin taking opportunity through the commandment. In other words, it's exactly the same phraseology. So verse 11 builds off of the information in verses 8, 9, and 10. But the point is that he says sin had an opportunity. And so that's where we want to start our study and our thinking. The nature of sin's opportunity. Paul actually says in verse 8, taking opportunity. But that word is lambano, and it means either to take or to receive. And the context determines whether it's taking or receiving. And in my understanding of the text, sin didn't take an opportunity, it received one. He's literally talking about the sin. And in Paul's terminology, the sin is always a reference back to Adam's choice in the garden, because that's when the sin introduced sin as a concept in our whole created setting as human beings. And so when he talks about the sin, he's also talking about the original and all the impact from there, because all of our behavior is caused by the fact that the sin created a whole generation of, and by generation I mean propagation, a whole race of people who are dominated by the two outcomes of sin's introduction into the garden by the serpent, the fear of death and the spirit that came in along with Adam's capitulation, called the spirit of the disbelief. But that spirit is identified in Ephesians 2 as the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who works in the sons of the disbelief. So in a very real sense, Adam opened the door for the subjugation of his entire race to this spirit. The thing is that he calls it in this text, or the New American Standard, opportunity. I think King James uses the word occasion. But when you look at that word that's translated opportunity, it's a word that indicates the timely arrival of an opportune event for someone to take a specific action that will serve that someone's goal in taking the action. In other words, if a person wants to accomplish something and he is biding his time to be able to do the thing that will necessarily result in the accomplishment of his objective, he needs to wait until there's a timely, opportune moment where things are in place so that he can stick his 2 cents worth in and get the thing out of it that he wants. And this is precisely what was going on in the garden in Genesis 3. The serpent didn't come into the garden willy-nilly. He came into the garden with an intention of perverting the human race, and he probably came in at an opportune time, because he couldn't wait for Adam and Eve to get too entrenched in their confidence in God, or he would never get them to buy his line. early on. He had to get in there before Adam and Eve in their development, their own development and understanding and growth and wisdom. He had to get in there while they were susceptible to the subtlety of his arguments, because if they had grown past the subtlety, if they were like Paul said, we're not ignorant of his devices, well, if they hadn't been ignorant of his devices, they would have never been able to be sucked in. So he came in at an opportune time, and the idea was that he had a specific thing that he, if he could get it accomplished, it would accomplish his goal of twisting humanity. And in our context, the timely arrival is the point in time when a law is set forth by a lawgiver. Now, in verses 9 and 10, we are actually told point blankly that Paul is talking here in this context about his own experience as a believer. We'll get into verse 9 and 10 next week, Lord willing. But in verse 9, when he says, I was once alive apart from the law, that can only refer to his status as a believer, because that's the only time he was alive and apart from the law. He was born into Judaism. He was born under the dominion of the sin. He was subject to all of Judaism's legalisms, and he early on had determined that he was going to excel in obedience to the law so that he could bring his own status up in the culture to where he could be the Pharisee of the Pharisees. He, in my thinking, wanted to surpass Gamaliel in reputation so that he could be the top Pharisee. Well, he was dead in his trespasses and sins all the time of that going on. So there's no way he could say, I was alive once apart from the law, unless he was talking about his post-conversion reality. We'll talk more about that next time. But my point here is that the timely arrival in this text is the point in time when a law is set forth by a lawgiver. He says the law, particularly in verse 7, was, you shall not lust. And he said, as soon as that thou shalt not was uttered by the lawgiver, then it revealed Saul's or Paul's lusting. And he said, I wouldn't have known that it was wrong if I hadn't had this law given. So that's his illustration. A law set forth. As soon as a law is given, and it doesn't really matter which one. I mean, in the garden, the law was, don't eat of the fruit of that tree. In the day you eat of it, you will die. Surely you will die. Well, there's nothing clearer than that. Don't do it, because this is what's going to happen. So, in regard to all of the rest of giving of imperative statements, which is what law is. It's an imperative statement. All through humanity's experience, many, many imperatives have been given. Even the New Testament is full of imperatives. Well, you can take all those imperatives and put yourself under them as under law, and if you do, you'll die spiritually. So in the context, it's just the point in time when a law is set forth. In this context, the opportune event is the giving of what Paul calls a commandment. Verse 8 says, sin receiving or having received an opportunity through the commandment. So it's now not just law, but it's specifically an imperative, a commandment. And in this context, the specific action that's taken is the subtle twisting of the divine intent for the giving of a commandment into a different intent. In other words, in the garden, Satan went in there to distort the whole issue of God's reason for giving a law. God gave the commandment, don't eat of the fruit of that tree, because the problem of sin had already been introduced into creation by the angelic rebellion. And there had to be a clarity so that Adam and Eve couldn't be easily drawn into the whole issue of the rebellion. And so the law provided that clarity. Don't do this. If you do, you'll die. There isn't anything could be more clear than that. And yet, because clarity doesn't help without faith, They were deceived. It actually says in verse 11, the commandment deceived me. So there is an issue of a subtle twisting. That's the deception. The specific action is a deception. That's what verse 11 says. It received this opportunity through the commandment, deceive me. Well, this whole deception thing, if you look at that word that's translated deception, deceived, it's a word that's used to indicate a subtle twisting of truth. 2 Corinthians 11:3 is an illustration of the subtlety of the twisting. 2 Corinthians 11:3. He says, I am afraid lest as the serpent deceived Eve, because the serpent was more subtle than any of the other beasts of the field, this subtle twisting, he deceived Eve by his craftiness. I'm afraid that the same thing will happen to you, he says. So with Eve, there was this subtle twisting. And with the Corinthians, there was the possibility of a subtle twisting. And in chapter 7 of Romans, verse 8, the opportunity is a subtle twisting. And the twisting is illustrated by all three of the major temptation accounts. Genesis 3, Matthew 4, Luke 4. In every case, in every stage of the temptation, Satan twists facts to an illegitimate conclusion. He states real fact, but then he applies that fact to an illegitimate application. He says, since you're the Son of God, there's really no reason for you to go hungry. This fasting for 40 days and 40 nights is nonsense. You don't have to do this. You're the Son of God. You can command those stones to turn into bread and you can eat it. And you have no mandate from God to, this is not recorded, but there was implied in that, that Jesus had no mandate from God to fast. Just eat. You have the power and you can do it. But it was a subtle temptation in this regard, that Jesus taught his disciples that their prayer should be, give us this day our daily bread. And then he followed up later by saying, which one of you as a father, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Jesus' theology kicks in where he prays in the desert as he's been led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. He prays for his daily bread, just like he told his disciples to do. And there's no bread. So his assumption has to be, I have asked my Father for bread. He would not give me a stone. If there is no bread, he clearly intends me to fast. There's no complication with that kind of logic. It's very clear that eating's a necessary function for the human body. And it's not clear that Jesus is under some kind of divine mandate to fast. So the rationale that Jesus followed has to be understood in light of his Big T theology. He asked the Father out there in the wilderness for something to eat, and the Father didn't give him anything to eat. Well, what do you draw from that? God's a liar? He failed me? No. You draw from that that God intends for you to fast. And then Satan comes along and says, no, it's not necessary for you to fast. This is a subtle twist. And the same thing goes on with the other things. Satan says, it's written in the Word of God that God will give his angels power regarding you so that you won't even stub your toe on a rock while you're in the world. So, it would be perfectly legitimate for you to cast yourself off the temple because the angels will catch you and let you down easy and you'll just be like Superman, just land real easy and you won't stub your toe. And this will prove that you're the Son of God and everybody will be wowed by the demonstration and all that. And he faced the same kind of temptation while he was hanging on the cross. If you're the Son of God, prove it. Come off the cross. And then we'll believe in you. Yeah, right. But my point is, the methodology is to take something that's factually true and then twist the application of it. So, in the records of the temptations, we have this illustration, or these illustrations of the subtle twisting. And the issue of sin receiving an opportunity, having received an opportunity by the placement of a commandment. This is how it works. The specific nature of the twist in our context is the turning of a commandment intended to reveal, verse 7, the point of the law is to get me to the knowledge that this is not legitimate behavior. It's revelation. Well, how has that revelation purpose by God been twisted? From the very beginning of the words, it has been twisted into imperative means obedience, means you have the capacity to obey. It means do it. Well, Paul says, no, that's not right. The commandment, thou shalt not lust, does not imply my capacity to not lust. It just tells me that if I do, I'm sinning. That's all. It's a revelation. And revelation of what's right and what's wrong is no ability implied for regulation. You can't get people to obey just because you make the law clear. If they don't have the capacity for it, they aren't going to do it. So, I think the specific nature of the twist in our context and in the biblical context is the turning of a commandment intended to reveal and to turn the commandment into an instrument of merit intended to put men under both a demand performance and a threat of death for failure to comply, coupled to the idea that they're capable of obedience. I know there are a lot of people who say, well, why would God tell you to do something you couldn't do and then threaten you if you didn't do it? Well, that's the whole issue in this text. Is the answer to the question is, did God give a commandment that he intended for you yourself to obey and then threaten you with death if you didn't obey him? Was that his purpose? Or was his purpose to give you a commandment that is loaded up with consequence for failure, but was that giving designed to energize your obedience, or was it designed to simply reveal your incapacity? And it's been my argument for years that the whole problem with humanity is their overconfidence in their capacity. In fact, I was talking to a group of guys that meet on Tuesday night at the house, and the issue of law came up, and I said, what does the Bible say pleases God? Is it obedience or faith? Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. It doesn't say without obedience, it's impossible. And the reason for that is, obedience is the natural outworking of the right kind of believing. So the real problem is not disobedience, it's unbelief. So if you want to please God, you got to trust him. And in your trusting, you free him up to do what he said he would do if you would trust him. So if you're trusting him and he's giving you some kind of revelation that says, I want you to move that mountain from there to there, and you say, I don't have the ability to do that, but I'll trust you to move it. And so you trust him and he moves it. That's the real scenario. It's not ever God giving us a command so that if we trust him, then we can do it. That's not the idea. The idea is if we trust him, he will do it, because faith is the thing that gets God to act on our behalf. It's not something that gets us to act on God's behalf. So the real issue in the twist, when sin received an opportunity through the giving of a commandment, he is saying the opportunity was there for the subtle twisting. And the subtlety is real because almost everybody buys into the notion that God wouldn't tell you to do something you can't do. Sure, if he tells you to do something, he wants you to do it. And so if you really want to be on God's side in this whole business, you just need to be obedient. Well, how's that work for you? Really? So, the conclusion that we have to draw in terms of the nature of sin's opportunity is that sin receives an opportunity every time man becomes aware of a legal demand made by God. Anytime God says, do this, sin is sitting there. It's now got an opportunity to try to twist your brain and twist your mind and twist your thinking into some kind of self-capacity for merit's sake. Because the whole idea here is he promised Adam and Eve that they could be their own little Elohim. They could control their own lives if they would just eat of the fruit. And God didn't want them to be able to do that, so he forbade them. That's not true, but that's the lie he gave them. Well, every time somebody receives a demand or a command from God, the opportunity for, oh, if I do this, then I'll be a good Christian. I can look down my nose at everybody that isn't doing it. And all that is ego gratification built out of merit. So that's the opportunity. And this opportunity is the chance for the sin to insert its insidious twist of the divine intent in giving any law. The whole New Testament, I believe, has to be interpreted on the basis of Pentecost. God said, you can't do this. I'm going to give you the Spirit of Jesus to do this. He will live in your body, in the life that you live. You will live by the faith of Jesus in this mix. So it's not I, but Christ. So that's the whole point. He gave us His Spirit. Pentecost was the demonstration of the giving of the Spirit. And any interpretation of anything in the New Testament that doesn't assume the presence of the Spirit for the performance of the divinely desired action is a misinterpretation. Paul says the action that the sin took in verse 8 in this whole process of deception and so forth was that it produced in me coveting of every, or lusting of every kind. Paul says the sin produced all manner of violations of the individual commandment. You shall not lust all of a sudden became a litany of sins, lusting after all kinds of stuff. So one commandment and a multitude of behavior violations of the commandment. Sin produced that. How? Well, I believe that the production depended upon man's present post-Genesis 3 built-in susceptibility to spiritual rebellion against God. Paul says we come into this world constituted sinners. And he says in Romans 8, a little bit later in our study, that the mindset on the flesh is at war with God. So there is this natural propensity, knee-jerk, default, reaction to what God says do, and you don't want to do it just because God says to do it. Or if he says don't do it, you want to do it. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. That's the mindset. From the very beginning, man had a need for confidence in the goodness of God, and a need for confidence in the goodness of God was immediately exploited by the serpent through a devious set of lies. Genesis 1 says, it was good. It was good. He saw that it was good. It was good. The only thing that was not good was that he was dwelling alone. Everything was good, which had to argue that the God who made it was good. Had to. Can't get good fruit from a corrupt tree. So Adam and Eve were in the garden. Everything around them was good. They could tell it was beneficial to them. And along comes the serpent, and he says, God is not as good as you think he is. He really wants to keep you from this knowledge that you will gain from eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because there are certain benefits to eating that he doesn't want you to have. And therefore, that shows that he's not as good as you think he is, because he's trying to keep you from these benefits. If you will eat it, you will know good and evil, and then you'll be able to protect yourself from his manipulations, and you can be your own God. If Adam and Eve had been thoroughly grounded in their confidence that God was good, they'd have never bought that. It was an exploitation based on the shortness of their experience with God before it was a settled reality in their own way of thinking. And so, from the very beginning, man has had this profound need to believe in the goodness of God. But everywhere you turn, that is denied. Everywhere you turn. After Adam's participation in the sin, man's need for such confidence has been seriously undermined by the very presence of any and all of the demands that God makes. Because when you take a lack of confidence in the goodness of God, then demands become the orders of an adversary. And therefore, because he's an adversary, his demands are not for your sake. They're for his sake. He is demanding from you for his sake, not for yours. And every time you get a command from somebody that's your adversary, you just automatically resist, rebel. So this undermining was done through man's lack of ability to meet the demands and through the emotional reactions that set in when failure sets in. Every time man is faced with a demand that God makes and man tries to obey it and fails, his already present antagonism toward God is deepened by the anger of being told to do something that he cannot find in himself to do. And the emotional consequence of being demanded of something you can't do, given the character of the demander as a self-centered manipulator, just builds rage or despair. So the immediate reality was, as soon as the command is, don't lust, all of a sudden lust just pops up everywhere. It's a multiplication of violations of God's demands. And it's either by reason of rage or by despair, because both of them do it. The command is kind of like focusing on the one thing you don't want to focus on. It's kind of like you really would like to be able to lose some weight, so you decide that you're going to control your appetite so you lose weight. And the way to do that is to always concentrate on all this food that's around you and how good it would taste, right? No, if you do that, you're sunk. But what does putting yourself under the demand of controlling your appetite do for you? It focuses you on how hungry you are, and it just pushes your buttons. And that's why even people with a very strong will, typically they can lose some weight, but just as typically, the chances are very great that they'll lose that over time and then they'll regain it all back. Because the way our bodies are built, if you ever build a fat cell, it's there. And it's always wanting to be filled. So if more food goes by than is necessary for your body, it'll just reach out and grab some of that and store it. Well, after a little while, that fat cell's full. Well, then you need another fat cell, so your body makes another one. And it sits there waiting to grab this excess food that you're sticking in your body, and it fills itself up. And if you starve yourself down, those fat cells will start giving up that store. But they're still there, and they're still hungry. And so it's very, very difficult. Well, all of this is just an illustration of this whole thing everybody has experience with. And it can be, it doesn't have to be food. It can be drug addiction. It can be anything that gets your focus of attention. And if God says, don't do that, what's he do? He focuses, that commandment focuses your attention on the very thing that will destroy your ability to be obedient. So there are two kinds of people that will respond to these demands in that regard. One kind is they'll try it, but they'll fail, and then they'll get despairing. Now, it may take them a long time to really get to despair, because people are like, you know, they're crazy. The definition of crazy is you try the same thing over and over and get the same result and expect a different one. Well, that's kind of the way it is. You try to behave and you don't. And you try again, you don't. And you try again, you don't. And you think the answer is to try harder. Well, that's not going to work. So the sin, actually, by taking advantage of the commandment's presence and then twisting the intention of God in that, forgiving it, it just makes you if you go into despair, it makes you throw up your hands and say, what's the use? Give me the ice cream. There's no point. I can't do this. I might as well enjoy going to hell because there's no other option. The other kind is the kind who is very self-righteous, blinded to his own failures, though not really blinded. In other words, you can be blinded, but beneath your own awareness, you're not. And when you see yourself being commanded by God to do stuff you can't do, despair isn't the only reaction. Rage is often the reaction. And so which of the groups of people in the New Testament were most rage-filled toward Jesus? It was the Pharisees. And they were the most self-righteous. And in their self-righteousness, they had in their inner heart a rage against the lawgiver. And Jesus' claim to be that one just filled them with rage. And so they set up to murder him, thinking that that'll get rid of it. But they didn't understand. So Paul winds up this verse by saying this. If there hadn't been a commandment, then sin would have been dead. In other words, if God hadn't have said, don't do it, then you could have done it and you wouldn't have gotten fixated on it and you'd gone on about your business. If he had put that tree in the garden that was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and he hadn't said, don't eat it, you'd eat a fruit off of that one and then you'd go over and eat this fruit over there and then you'd eat another one and another one. And if this one tasted particularly good, you'd come back and eat another. And then you'd go over there, because all of them tasted really, really, really good. And you wouldn't have been fixated on this one. But the commandment fixated you on it. And the twist underneath that fixation created either despair or rage, and that just multiplied the violations. All of a sudden, you couldn't get enough of the fruit of that tree. So instead of going to all those others and eating, every time you got hungry, you'd want to come back and eat that one. Well, if there hadn't been a law given, Paul says at the end of verse 8, sin would have had no effect. That's what being dead means. It's being separated from the ability to accomplish its goal. If God hadn't said, don't, the serpent wouldn't have been able to successfully get them to do something wrong because there was nothing identified as wrong. The sin couldn't manipulate the rage, despair, production of sins if there hadn't been a commandment. So that's Paul's argument in verse 8. God's intention in giving the law, according to verse 7, was revelation. But sin's intention in taking the commandment and twisting it into a poor theology a poor theology of God and a poor theology of man, that's what produced the explosion of sin. And we'll get into the rest of how it works in verses 9 and following in the weeks to come, Lord willing. But this verse simply says there's nothing wrong with the law. It's sin having received an opportunity through the presence of a commandment that created all the problem. And that's not a reflection on law as in terms of its essence. It's just a reflection on how the sin used it. And the use of it, according to verse 11, which we will eventually get to, was a deceitful use.